Well done, thou good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little. We shall set you over much. Enter into the joy of the master. Check for a moment and see if you have some change, a coin or two in your pocket or in your pocketbook. And if so, come with me for a moment. We're going to take a visit. Pay a call in a village five and dime store. This is not Wall Street, and this is not even Main Street. This is a back street, but you love this store. You've been coming here for decades, one way or another. Here, as a child, you are able to buy a Halloween mask or a scarf in the winter or a squirt gun in the spring or a yo-yo come summer. And when autumn returns, you can return yourself and find a pen and a paper and a pad. The gathering there each day, each weekday, is in the midst of a small business. The economic backbone of some of our communities still is made of small farms and small stores and small enterprises. Like this one, John Wesley said of his English folk, "We are a nation of shopkeepers," and still it is so across the Northeast in many places. The aroma, the scent of the space is as it was four decades, five decades and more ago, a mysterious mixture of newsprint and perfume and paste and bubblegum. And when you step on the tongue and groove wood floor, it only creaks in one spot, and you know ahead of time whence the sound. This simple store is the stage on which an elder man gives his daily, his weekly performance. He has a shock of white hair and a handlebar mustache, and he has that gladness, that permanence, amid all of the impermanence of his setting, impermanent goods, impermanent seasons, impermanent expenditures. Why he should be so blessed is a bit of a mystery still, for of anyone in that town, he might have the most reason to question his role. His clients are about 4 feet tall. Their income is made through the mowing of lawns and the shoveling of sidewalks and the raking of leaves and the delivery of newspapers. They are diminutive. They have to reach up to touch the counter. And how he ever made a living, one does not know. But in the midst of all that impermanence, he had a sense of something lasting. He looked a little bit like the Wizard of Oz. When I sat with him in midlife at a Rotary meeting, a fellow visiting Rotarian with him, he had that same dark delight in his happy eyes. When our son Christopher was six, on his birthday, we happened to be near the town, so we stopped in to find some candles and a fishing pole, and I reached down to get the Wall Street Journal and looked up just in time to see Chris fingering inside his wallet. Now, I hadn't seen him buy anything before. I haven't seen him buy much since. He's a frugal soul. But there was a candy that had caught his eye, and he'd tiptoed up to put it on the counter, and he was fishing in that moment that passes from childhood to maturity, from young adulthood to emerging adulthood. They are, in some ways, the college years so represented. And he waited to make that final decision. The wizard knew better than to say anything or to interfere or to offer help. He just leaned in the sunlit, sun-dappled morning and waited. And in that eternity, these first experiences, almost any, are such holy moments. After a moment, out came the coin. Up it went on the counter, down came the candy, and the deal was struck. Somehow, over time, and we don't have much time, wants the impermanent essential needs of the day are met, once we have a sense of the impermanence of goods and exchange and seasons, there can emerge, perhaps this morning for you, another kind of desire, a different kind of longing, a distinct, discrete otherness of heart, a longing not for the impermanent, but a longing for what lasts, matters, counts, is real. A longing for, a desire for, an experience of God. People come to church hungry, hunting for an experience of grace, love, delight, divine love. The desire, as Shelley put it, the desire of the moth for the flame, of the night for the morrow, the devotion to something afar from the sphere of our sorrow. The prophet Micah ben Imlah, and we'll interpret our gospel today through the Hebrew scripture and through the epistle both, 7 centuries and more before the life of Jesus of Nazareth, had that same longing over against the similarly impermanent condition of his situation. And he brought you an epigram. You can write it if you need to, but you can remember it full well, about how to find a path out from under impermanence toward what lasts. He recognized, as you perhaps do, that one path toward God lies through generosity, through the use of talents, 5 talents, 2 talents, 1 talent, all. So Micah ben Imlah reminded us, what does the Lord require of you but to do and to love and to walk, to do justice, to love mercy, to walk humbly? In our time across the globe and in the Middle East and across the country and in the middle American states and this week and in these hours, we shall need to muster, shall we not, a prayerful path toward what lasts through the doing of justice, in giving and speaking and acting to make sure that we do so justly in a way that helps to make and keep human life human. And to love, whom to love, how to love. We have a proclivity to, as Augustine put it, love what we should use and use what we should love. We tend to love the visible and the material and the tangible and to use those about us, sister and brother and other. We need to love people, to use things, and to walk with a bit of humility. You know, most of us have more in our pockets than just the 6-year-old's quarter and dime. We carry, many of us, a bill or two more, though we should ever, especially Sunday, be aware of those at the dawn of life, the twilight of life, and the shadows of life who have great need. We, though carrying around what we do, our clothing and our positions and our degrees and our material well-being, we might benefit from a reminder to walk humbly. Amid the impermanence of today, November 16th, 2014, there is a lingering longing, is that right, on your part, for an experience of God. The Apostle to the Gentiles, the 27 books of the New Testament, are all written in Greek, and it could be argued that they are all written by Gentiles, except those sent from the Apostle to the Gentiles, Paul of Tarsus. Paul puts impermanence in sizzle mode. He has come in Greek and speaking to a Hellenistic world, but he is doing so with his inheritance of apocalyptic eschatology. You heard it last week when Brittany Lungsdorf read from 1 Thessalonians. The Lord himself will descend with the cry of command, the archangel's call, the sound of the trumpet of God. The dead in Christ will rise first. Then we, the living, the remaining, shall be caught up together with him in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, so we shall always be with the Lord. That's an expectation. That's permanence. That's impermanence personified. That's impermanence on sizzle mode. And so here, speaking to the moral failings of his Corinthians, Paul will say, I mean, brothers and sisters, the time has grown very short. He expects the end. Therefore, let those who have wives live as if they had none, those who mourn and rejoice as if they were not mourning and rejoicing, those who buy and sell as if they had no goods, those who deal with this world as if they had no dealings with it, for the form of this world is passing away. It can happen 3 years into college or 40 years into life that you realize over time that all this impermanence, seasonal, material, exchange, change, is making way for another longing, perhaps yours this morning, a longing for an experience of the divine. It's easy, in fact, even for the clergy, too easy to forget. People come to church hungry for an experience of God. One path toward such an experience is through giving and through generosity. Now, each November you have heard us and you have forcefully and fruitfully responded. You have heard the need of Marsh Chapel to support the ministry here. We're looking for a donor to complete the endowment of the deanship. We're learning for several donors to help us refurbish our building. We're looking for many others to help us support our global and musical and ministerial outreach. Thank you for your generosity. But today, this November, we speak an encouraging word not about this space or this ministry, but about those churches across New England who over the next 6 weeks will appeal to your support. You know, those listening on the radio, many of you have come out of your own service and are heading home on the highway, or others of you are at home because you are ill or homebound and are listening to Marsh Chapel, but you have a home church. Or you are at work and were not able to go to your own hometown church, so you're listening on the radio. And we appreciate your connection, your participation in the gospel here. But sometime in the next 6 weeks, you'll receive an invitation from your local church inviting you to support the ministry there. And I honor in this moment those clergy and lay leaders across New England who every November stand and speak and wait and hope. I think of the lights in the churches across New England, some dimmer, some brighter. What would happen if those lights became dim or went out? What would happen to children and education, to worship and music, to fellowship, discipleship, to mission and outreach? What would happen in those villages and towns and cities to the witness, to singing the song and ringing the bell and telling the tale of what lasts? Churches don't have a tax base on which to found their work, like, for instance, schools. Churches don't have some tangible good, some item to give and sell to found their ministry, unlike businesses or other. Churches don't even have diplomas or certificates to offer after 4 or 5 years, as does a university or a college. Here's what they have: courage, a spirited, adventurous soul, a willingness to stand in the wind of the unknown, and year by year depend utterly on your free will decision of what you are going to give. They are like some of the surfers that we shall see in San Diego this next week. The sun is up and the wind is blowing and the board is flowing and the tide is rolling, and they stand and they balance and they lean and they hang 10, and they may sail and they may fall, depending on what you decide to do. I honor them. I applaud them. And I'm grateful for their courage. You know, Jan and I were raised in a community of people who had that kind of willingness to say to one another in what they did and what they didn't do, don't get too comfortable. Recognize impermanence for what it is. They were older folks who had learned to tithe in their teenage years and had continued to do so through a lifetime. They were grizzled and veteran trustees who watched out for the building and the boiler and the endowment, and whose hearts were really in mission in Tegucigalpa. They were women who in prayer had given life and birth to various forms of children's and other ministry. And the clergy, they were itinerant. That is, and this is your heritage, Marsh Chapel. They came out of John Wesley's pattern of itinerant ministry among the poor. They went where they were sent, at the whim or the insight or the befuddlement or all of some general or district superintendent. They were willing, sometimes every 3 years, to pull up stakes, to leave the familiar for the unfamiliar, to live on a modest income, always with a guaranteed appointment, to plant a garden in the spring and not know whether they would be there to harvest it in the fall, and so, for that reason, to take all the more care as they did so. They lived, shall we not as well, with an existential reserve, a readiness to say in what is done and undone, don't get too comfortable. The form of this world is passing away. We were taught before we knew the words. We were taught in the music of life, the power, the potential for an experience of the divine that is embedded in generous giving. Some years ago, I officiated at a wedding. Most weddings have a little drama in them, as you're probably aware. This one was full of such. The soloist came as a friend of the bride and offered a beautiful musical interlude. Following the service, we talked and debriefed about the episode experience, the wonderful moment there. I asked her where she was from. She said, "Oh, you wouldn't know. It's a little village." I said, "Try me." She said, "Well, I was raised in Alexandria Bay, up on the river." And I said, "Oh, I know Alexandria Bay." She said, "Yes, my mother raised us there." I said, "Did you ever know the Reverend Harold Pennock? He was my wife's grandfather." And all of a sudden, a pleasant conversation became torment. Her eyes filled and her cheeks reddened, and she stammered, and I thought, isn't this just like the ministry? The pastor walks into a room and everybody feels uncomfortable. She couldn't speak. I said, "I'm so sorry." She said, "Oh, no, you don't understand. We lived in a very modest home. I loved music in the church, and I grew up singing. And as I came toward the conclusion of high school, your wife's grandfather took me aside and said, 'Have you ever thought you might like to go to college?'" She said, "No one in our family had ever been to college. I didn't know what to do. He took me to the library. He showed me the addresses. He helped with the letters. But once admitted and with a scholarship," she said, "there was still the matter of funding. We had no money. We had a struggling single-parent home. He said, well, why don't you, it's only 2.5 hours north. Why don't you go for a semester and we'll send you a little bit from the church. Just try it out. So every first of the month, the small check came. It wasn't only the money, it was the fact that someone in that town could see who I might become. And one semester led to a second, and 1 year to a second, and I completed my degree. But she said, it was only some years later that, you know how little towns are, I learned that the money came through the Alexandria Bay Methodist Church with a little post stamp there, but it came from Harold Pennock and his wife, Anstris. And by that point, we were both of full eye and red cheek. And I said, what are you doing now? And she said, well, I just finished teaching 30 years of music, and I'm the part-time director of a music program in a church in Albany. And I said, I thought I could see that coming. Generosity over time opens the door to an experience of the divine. Teachers, whether from Rochester, New York, or Boston, or any place in between, particularly know and live that and know it well. Well done, thou good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little. We will set you over much. Enter into the joy of the master. Don't get too comfortable. Tonight, when it's dark, the end of the day, I hope to go out on the esplanade. And I'm hoping you'll go outside too. I'll be thinking of you, maybe offering your evening prayer. And with you, I'll offer mine too. And you'll hear the squirrels hunting for food for the winter, and you'll see the frost on the grass. And if you're near the river, you'll see the shimmering of light on the water, and you'll feel that autumn breeze. And you'll think about whether a path toward the permanent might be opening for you this year in what you choose to do, to give, to offer. And your prayer might be mine, and our prayer might be this. Dear God, help me to love you this coming year by giving to others this coming year. Dear God, help me to love you this coming year by giving to others this coming year. Dear God, I'm going to need your help. I'm going to stretch and try to tithe. I've never done that. I want to, but the coin seems to stick a little bit in the wallet, and that makes me nervous. And the countertop is a real stretch, and that makes me nervous. And the wizard there is silent, and that makes me nervous too. I want to live in faith and exist in hope and act in love, but I need your help. Dear God, help me to love you this year by giving to others this year. Well done, thou good and faithful servant. You've been faithful over a little. We will set you over much. Enter into the joy of the master.